Right. I love that last bit of laughter there between the links. This is such a great group, and this is so much fun to hear from you guys about this. Last Sunday, I opened the sermon with a question, and I asked, how did you know that you were truly, really a grown-up adult? And then this week, I wanted to open it with a different question, one that kind of makes me chuckle. And if you have ever felt this way, maybe you haven't, if you've ever felt this way, how did you know you were getting older? What happened and you said, wow, I'm starting to get kind of old? Was there anything for you? I'll give you my example. I had trouble getting up from this little ledge and sitting down during children's time when I was pregnant. And I thought, well, that'll go away. And then now Penny is two and I still struggle to get up the way I used to. So I know I'm getting older. Others? Lori. When people call you ma'am, oh my gosh, that starts early. Alice. Needing reading glasses, oh yeah, yeah. And then looking down on them, over them, right? Others? Rich?
Trying to remember people's names.
Oh, right, people's names, and you've known them a long time and you can't come up with it. Yes, definitely. Did you have one, Winifred?
Oh.
The kids turning into adults. Yeah, that's huge. Oh, yeah. One more, Kyra. Oh. Oh, yeah. Isn't that amazing? So, if you haven't been there yet, we all have that sort of surreal phenomenon going, wow, time is moving on. Everyone is aging. So we may not all be old, but we are all aging, right? And today, we're moving into the third part of this stewardship sermon series, Giving Through the Ages. And we're looking at this age of earning. We're looking at these adults who more or less have established themselves. They've built up a life and an identity. At work, they're probably the leaders in their careers, or at least the people who know how everything works. They might be the ones who supervise and mentor. And then at home, they have built a family with kids who are getting jobs and driving and maybe even leaving the nest. This is the group that society tends to call middle-aged. But it's such a funny term because, like you maybe heard me say to the kids, that is something we really take for granted more recently, because just as recently as 100 years ago, the average life expectancy was 47 years old. So there was no second half of life to speak of. So we're really lucky we even have this whole middle-aged thing that's gone on. And we can't even agree at what age it really starts. You heard the kids had different opinions. The average age, when they polled a whole bunch of Americans, what counts as middle age? The average age people said it begins is early 50s. Some said earlier, some said later, but we disagree on this. In that great book that I mentioned to you last week called 100 Years, that was written by a guy who was just compiling different quotes for every single age, 0 to 100, I found some good ones for this stage. For age 50, he chose the ancient philosopher Plato, who said of being 50, "The time has now arrived at which they must raise the eye of the soul to the universal light that lightens all things, and then behold the absolute good." That sounds really deep, but I feel like it's saying all of a sudden you're very concerned with purpose. You start to see this looming task of reevaluating your impact in the world and looking again at what's important and seeing if your day-to-day matches what that is for you. And then for age 60, he chose an interesting quote. He chose Tom Wolfe, who simply wrote, "It got harder and harder to feel indispensable at age 60. So you're reevaluating your purpose, but you sort of see yourself and your importance, how seriously you take yourself, in a whole different light, is what I took from that quote. And that could be very freeing, but it could also be pretty terrifying. This stage of life encompasses two major generations, and the first is baby boomers. The younger half of the baby boomers are in this stage of life, those who are still working, probably still pre-retirement, and those are the ones we're considering today. And I think it's funny because churches always talk about how we're missing young adults in the church, and we are. Those 20-somethings we often don't have in any church, but this is a group that's often missing too. In our church, when we logged the numbers of all the different age groups, this is a group that actually is the lowest interestingly enough, those younger baby boomer age. And if you think about it, this group is notorious for being the first generation to ever rebel against organized religion or against organized anything, right? Many of them in this area have had to find secure jobs working for the federal government, but in doing that, they've gotten even more impatient than the rest of us with inefficient decision making and endless meetings, which, let's be honest, are a big part of church life, yes? So a lot of them maybe aren't in the churches, and the good news about that is that studies have shown as this generation does age, they're coming back into spirituality and religion. They're seeing it as a potential source for that purpose and community and comfort. I have to say, some of our most vibrant and generous members are from this age group, and I think the church would do well, the church as a whole, to do more outreach to this group, not just to those cool, hip, tech-savvy young adults, but to this group, because they have a lot to give us. They want to use their skills that they've developed at work for more than just work. They want to use them for a purpose. And they know what it is to grow up and build things during a time of rapid change. Think of women's lib and civil rights and rock and roll. These were all formative when they were just growing up. And their dissatisfaction with traditional top-down authority could offer us new ways of doing things in church that could benefit us if we allow that to happen. Now, the other group in this stage of life, in this middle age, is the often overlooked, often totally forgotten, Generation X. There was a recent story on CNN that had an infographic, like a picture, showing the generations trying to explain them to the public, and it had baby boomers, millennials, and they didn't even put Generation X on the infographic. It wasn't even on there. They just left out this whole group of people. So it just goes to show it's a smaller group, like 1965 to 1980, I remember, and they've often been called America's neglected middle child. This is the group that grew up during the AIDS epidemic and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the grunge era and huge spikes in divorce rates. And they were given their name because this was a generation that did not particularly want to be defined by anything. So X. Yet even though they were not the ones to start some of these big movements like civil rights, they are the ones who grew up in those formative years with the results of those societal changes. I think that's really important. So for example, Generation X is the first generation to grow up in fully integrated schools. What would that experience have to give us growing up with that? Our kids have that now, but they were the first ones to experience that. And then when we think of what they can teach us, I like to think of this generation spiritually as like the latchkey kid. They really take care of themselves. They're very self-reliant, very practical. It's not just my opinion. All these articles and analysis of this group bears that out. They're very self-reliant. They're able to take care of themselves, and yet they have the same needs as the rest of us. What can that teach the church? There's an article in The New Yorker by a writer named Emily Nussbaum, and what she said was, the flip side of the irony and gloom that characterized Generation X culture is actually a kind of pragmatic resilience. I love that. So really practical, but also with some hope. Trying to make things better, but maybe a little under the radar, behind the scenes. And couldn't the church use more of that? Both of these groups who fall into the middle age stage of life, they're facing a developmental task that we all will face, that is just figuring out what is going to outlast them. Because they're starting to realize they are not going to last forever. And does church seem relevant in helping them to work through that? Does it seem relevant to them? Do we give those of you who are asking that question opportunities to get out there and try new things, to stretch out of your comfort zone, to be fed with new ideas? Are we giving you that? And if not, the church has to pray about that. That's part of our role in your lives. And in addition, does church help at all with some of the challenges you face? Because like you heard in the video, this group is in the prime position of being in that sandwich generation, sandwiched between kids who need a lot of their attention and their help, and then elderly parents who have more complex needs for care all of the time. Because people are living longer, their parents are living longer, and this is the group that kind of started the trend of having kids a little later in life. So they could very easily have a parent with all these needs and a toddler who needs everything from them, all their money, all their time, all their energy. And they are considered the ones able to make all the big decisions and be responsible. But do they feel equipped for that? Is the church helping with that? This is the stage where we often hear about the phenomenon of the midlife crisis, right? Some of you may have experienced that. Some of you may be worried about that. In this very youth-oriented society, the reality of our aging sneaks up on us until, as the popular narrative goes, one day we wake up and we just can't take it anymore. It being the monotony or the responsibility or the status quo or the question nagging, is this all there is? Is it going to be like this the rest of my life? It's not good, it's not bad, but is this all there is? That sneaks up on us, and then the story goes we have to find an escape hatch from that. So you hear about people who take the escape hatch of a divorce or an affair or a new car or quitting their job or a big trip or plastic surgery. You hear about all these things happening at this crucial pivot point in life. But it might simply look like unexplained depression or irritability or malaise. But I think, and I'm not the only one, all these articles that analyze this agree with me. This does not have to be a crisis. Midlife does not have to be a crisis. Maybe it is an invitation to renewal. Maybe it's a midlife awakening and something we can all learn from at any age. We can all learn from the fact that people really, truly can change and grow. We don't just have to keep going on autopilot. Like the song Mike sang, we don't have to just survive. We can thrive. We can do more than that. The restless, spiritually blah feeling that often gets termed a midlife crisis could be compared with what ancient monks, so many, many centuries ago, called asadia, which what they meant was noonday demon. That's how they translated it, noonday demon. And that was to describe a phenomenon they saw within themselves, because monks, what do they do all day, every day? They pray all day, every day. They're quiet all day, every day. And do you think that that's easy for them? They're people. It's not easy. It's really hard. And they've all agreed the hardest part was when you got to noonday, when you got to about that halfway point and you would get restless, you would get unmotivated, distracted, and that feeling of being in a rut. Even monks would feel that way. And they would have that sense of, I've got to stop. I've got to get out. So the same thing for us, that's comparable to that midlife crisis we hear about. How can we make it through the rest of this day or this stage or this life feeling that way? That's the question. And those same monks' answer to that feeling, I think, could cost a whole lot less than a vacation or a new car. And it actually, their answer sounds a whole lot like Paul in Philippians today. They say, press on. Press on, embrace the feeling, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Our culture tells us that if we're uncomfortable, something must be wrong. It's a problem to be fixed. But they say, get comfortable with being uncomfortable. This is some of the true growth in life. And then they also say, simply use your body right where you are so that you can remind your spirit, hey, I'm alive. This is a gift. I'm alive. And what they would do is scrub floors and weed gardens, use their bodies. And they say, let go of other people's expectations of you. Those can weigh so heavy. Those are the things of the past to be thrown off, like Paul says, and instead to press on towards what is ahead of us so that we can look for where God is in all of this, because God is in every stage in life. But we usually wind up seeing what we're looking for. So if we're only looking for the things that frustrate us or make us feel in a rut, they're going to loom large. If we're looking for God, we might see God. So just like Paul talks about later in this letter to the Philippians, this short letter, he says we actually have to train our thinking to focus on things that are good and noble and pure and praiseworthy. To train our thinking. He says we're not running this race in vain. We're not doing all this for no purpose. We're not running in vain. We're confident God will continue to carry on the good work he began in us, so we don't have to only look backwards. We are lucky to live in this time where most of us will reach the opportunity of middle age. We are so lucky, and we'll experience two halves of life. The Franciscan priest and popular writer Richard Rohr, some of you may have heard of him, he wrote a book that was called falling upward. And it's saying that we are all stuck in a first half of life culture that is focused on the preoccupations of youth, focused on looking good, on building up ourselves, making a name for ourselves. What he says we're doing is we're building a container. And that's important. In those first half of life years, we're building a container, but then in midlife, we all of a sudden go, oh, what's going to fill this container that I've built? What's going to go inside? And he says, most of us tend to think of the second half of life as largely about getting old, dealing with health issues, and letting go of our physical life. But what looks like falling can largely be experienced as falling upward into a broader and deeper world where the soul has found its fullness, is finally connected to the whole, and lives inside the big picture. He's not talking about heaven. That beautiful language is not talking about what we can experience in heaven. It's talking about life here now, if we can embrace what it has to offer. Perhaps those of you who are going through this stage can teach all of us about what it might look like to fall upward and to press on, to make faith about more than simply going through the motions, and instead build a whole community together that is reaching for a prize of surpassing worth. Amen.